evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another edition of Warrior Connection on the Progressive Radio Network. As we move forward, we want to remember that you always, veterans, will always have total respect from everybody and anything associated with Warrior Connection, because we're vets ourselves. For individuals that are promoting safety, health, environmental care, everything, that's what we do for the Progressive Radio Network and Warrior Connection. Hey there. Hi there, Patricia.
How are you, sir? Good to hear your voice.
Well, you know, we got another thing. I hope everybody had a happy Thanksgiving. For Thanksgiving, for me, it's a rather unique situation because in Thanksgiving 1969, I was headed back over to Southeast Asia for my participation in the Vietnam War on B-52s on Thanksgiving Day of 1969. And so what we're going to talk about tonight has a direct bearing on it, because at that time, obviously, I was had launch duty, so I was involved in full nuclear capability with B-52s in 1969 and all that. We did launch and go to failsafe one time. Everybody knows that. It's in the Nixon memoirs today.
And let's not forget, we deployed nuclear weapons against Iraq in Desert Storm, and we are routinely deploying tactical nuclear weapons.
Yeah, we continue to do so.
Yeah,
and then so in Desert Storm, again, Thanksgiving Day for me, because not only did I go back over on my second tour to Vietnam on Thanksgiving Day in 1969, but on Thanksgiving Day in 1990, you have to understand this is well over 20 years later, you know, long time after everybody's gone, I'm back on my way over to Desert Storm, again, on the nuclear, biological, chemical warfare end of it. We were plotting all the sub-Bowers Raiders at 3rd MedCom, did have the responsibility to plot all the nuclear strikes that were anticipated as the war started to heat up in January of 1991, so we were totally involved in that. And it was kind of freaky because in August of 1990, and I was back on active duty again. We were doing an air show and support and everything, a big military day out at Leary, Ohio, which is right near Cleveland. And I spent that weekend with Paul Tibbetts and his staff. And so we had a very interesting discussion because we knew what was happening in the Middle East already. We were already starting to plan for it and getting prepared and teaching. So, again, the whole idea, any possibility of the use of nuclear weapons frightens me completely.
As it should frighten any sane person.
It should be.
Absolutely.
And then we moved on, obviously, to depleted uranium, which used extensively. And still used today, and obviously depleted uranium is the main byproduct of the entire nuclear cycle, because when they need to make reactor fuel, or primarily nuclear bombs, what they do is they put into the mixture in the U.S. Department of Energy reactors, vessels, it's basically 99.2% uranium-238, 0.7% uranium-235, and 1.1% uranium-234. And what they want to do is extract the fissionable isotopes, and that's uranium-235, which is then used, and again, we can make plutonium from that in breeder reactors, and that's where we make our bombs from. So all this whole cycle is just a frightening, frightening situation.
And it's radioactive from start to finish. So
it's radioactive.
It is, absolutely. And when we call this material depleted uranium, we are succumbing to their weapon speak and their means and ways of detracting from the truth. DU is indeed radioactive. Let's face it. It's DU radioactive weaponry. But is John Steinbuck on board?
No, he's here.
Hello,
well, welcome.
John. How
welcome.
Are you?
Well, I'm pretty good, folks. And I'm a veteran myself, a veteran of the United States Coast Guard from active duty 1965 to 1969.
Mm-hmm. Good for you. And for benefit of those who don't know me or my voice, I am Patricia Axelrod, and I conduct the Desert Storm Think Tank and All Veterans Advocate, which was seeded by a grant I received from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation for my analysis of the modern battlefield from the satellites to the ground radars and all the platforms in between. So I can assure you folks listening that I, too, am all too sadly familiar with the madness of nuclear weaponry. And our program tonight, am I right, Doug, is called To Nuke or Not To Nuke? That is the question for us all.
Yeah, I think we need to. We brought John on because John, obviously, ladies and gentlemen, he's been on the program before, is an expert on the Middle East. He's an expert on nuclear weapons in the Middle East. And I've taught nuclear weapons forever and ever, but it's at a totally different level and having to prepare for the strikes. One thing that we did know, and Patricia, I know you're aware of it, and John, you're aware of it, is when Iraq did start launching the missiles, the Scud attacks, onto Israel during the December, January, February, March of 1990 and 91, what we did anticipate is that Israel would retaliate with their pole nuclear weapons that they do have in their possession. And that was a frightening thing for us, because not only were we prepared to use ourselves, but with Israel, they were just going to turn everything sand into glass, as we said it at that time. So it was totally, totally frightening. I guess this whole situation in the Middle East is spinning out of control. Israel again and the Palestinians are going at it hot and heavy. There seems to be a ceasefire in place right now. Egypt is coming unglued at the seams. We got Iraq still totally unstable, and who knows where that's going to go. Syria has completely been destabilized, I'm going to repeat, destabilized by design. And again, we're looking at the Syria stuff. We have to go back, and you can pull it up and go to the Internet or go to the library and pull it up. We have to understand that what Syria is about is running a natural gas pipeline through Syria out to the ports there coming out of Iraq and the other nations, and then also tapping into all of the natural gas and oil things that are in the Gaza Strip and all the way up the coast there.
Well, I'll be frank, if you'll be earnest, we three know for sure, and I'm sure many people listening know, that America is thoroughly committed to war for oil, that we are well prepared to squander our precious monetary resources and the precious lives of the young men and women who are serving in our military. And tonight, John, who is, as you've pointed out, is not only expert in matters of Israeli nuclear weaponry, he too has studied Iran and Iran's capabilities. And this becomes crucial, of course, because, as we all know, Israel and the American politicians have made unambiguous statements about retaliating against Iran if they even go so far as to build a nuclear weapon. And the hypocrisy of this, in light of the fact that the United States has in excess of 5,000 nuclear weapons, a policy of first strike that it has never renounced, and an ongoing policy called MAD, Mutual Assured Destruction, the hypocrisy of this is mind-boggling. And I think John can speak to this issue. John, vis-a-vis Iran, now you have written really extensively about this, and you have published peer-reviewed articles and popular articles, and you have lectured extensively. And if I might, I'm going to take the liberty of giving you what's called some talking points here vis-a-vis Iran. Let's discuss that first, if I could. And Doug, with your permission, I will cite a summary of an article that John wrote called Comparing Israel's and Iran's Nuclear Programs. And very quickly, in summarizing the differences, and this is directly from John Steinbach's article, and I want to urge everyone to access this article. John will tell us how to go about it. The title is called Comparing Israel's and Iran's Nuclear Programs, and John's last name is spelled Steinbach, and it was published July 2011, so it's extremely relevant. It's a special report, and John summarizes Iran's nuclear program as follows, in making the comparison between Iran and Israel. He says Iran is a signatory of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, while Israel refuses to sign the Non-Proliferation Treaty. The dean of the Israel Military Commentators has declared that, and this is coming from Israel, whoever believes that Israel will ever sign a UN convention prohibiting the proliferation of nuclear weapons is daydreaming. Iran has opened its nuclear facilities to unprecedented international inspection, while Israel refuses to permit any meaningful oversight. There is no credible evidence that Iran has ever mounted a nuclear weapons program, while Israel is universally acknowledged to possess several hundred sophisticated nuclear weapons, I might add, ranging from several hundred kilotons to nuclear grenades. And then Iran's leader, the Ayatollah, the most significant, the Ayatollah Al-Khamenei, has issued a religious decree against the acquisition, development, and use of a nuclear weapon, while Israel's leaders defend the Israeli bomb. For instance, in 1994, the director of the Israeli Institute for the Development of Weaponry said, "The moral and political meaning of nuclear weapons is that states which renounce their use are acquiescing to the status of vassal states, and Israel shall never do that." And so, despite all these differences, as John summarizes, he says there's an uninformed reader of the U.S. press might reasonably reach the conclusion that it is Iran that represents the greatest threat to nuclear stability in the Middle East, and in fact, it is Israel that fills that bill. So please, tell us about this.
Well, it's a little bit shocking. Listening to NPR, for example, last week I was listening to NPR, and they talked about Iran's nuclear weapons program. I've heard this repeated on some of the TV news shows. I've read it in the mainstream newspapers about Iran's nuclear weapons program. But if you actually look at the record, look at the evidence, according to the United States security establishment, the CIA and the NSA, this was in 2007. It was a national intelligence estimate that Iran does not have a nuclear weapons program. As recently as last year, the International Atomic Energy Agency, that is engaged in unprecedented on-site investigations of Iran's nuclear facilities, reiterated there is no evidence that Iran has a nuclear weapons program at all. So the accusation is that Iran has the capability of mounting such a program, but the problem there is that there are probably 2 dozen to 3 dozen nations in the world that all have the capability of mounting a nuclear weapons program, and that's what the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty is all about, to permit nations to pursue peaceful nuclear technology.
That's a program that the Peaceful Atom Program is a program that came about under Eisenhower, am I correct? And this is about the time, if you will correct me if I'm wrong, that in fact both Israel and Iran began their efforts to develop what was then called the Peaceful Atom. Is that right, John?
Well, it's not exactly right. We need to go back to 1953.
All right.
And Eisenhower gave his famous Atoms for Peace speech. And the reason he did that is that the U.S. had just exploded the first hydrogen bomb, and the world was getting very nervous. You had the scientists were rebelling. You had Bertrand Russell was holding war crimes tribunals, and there was tremendous opposition to the nuclear arms race. People were afraid all over the world, and so Eisenhower gave that speech to try to deflect attention away from the nuclear weapons program. So he, in 1953, gave that speech. That's the same year that Mohammad Mossadegh was overthrown and the Shah was instituted.
And that was a British and U.S. action.
I'm sorry, Doug.
On that overthrow there in Iran was a deliberate U.S.-British, MI6,
right,
and the CIA action, where again the decision was made to do that.
That's right. And John, as I recall, by this time in 1953, Israel was already en route to the development of a nuclear weapon, having begun their activities as early as 1948 or 49. Is that right, John?
That's correct. That's correct. Literally from the beginning of the establishment of the State of Israel, there was a commitment to develop nuclear weapons. And the rationale that was given at that time was that the Holocaust had happened and that that it would never happen again. And it was seen in the early days that nuclear weapons would be a guarantee against that. So even as early as 1948, Israel had already embarked on a program of a nuclear weapons development program. But it was really in 1953 with the Atoms for Peace that things moved ahead, both in Israel and in Iran. And so Israel, I believe, received the first of the 5-megawatt highly enriched uranium research reactors, which they turned into the backbone, if you will, of the beginnings of their nuclear weapons program. Iran did not get its identical reactor until the mid-1960s.
Mm-hmm. Can you give us more on the timeline and the development, the research and development? It's my understanding, John, that that France has played an enormous role in aiding both Iran and Israel, as well as South Africa and Germany. So perhaps you could just give us some discussion about these matters.
Well, that's correct. In the case of Israel, though, the point I would like to make, we should not see it as the French helping the Israelis. We should see it as a full-blown, full-fledged partnership, because Israel was sending its students primarily to the U.S. to learn nuclear engineering early on. And so when the French made their decision to move ahead with their bomb project, in their atomic bomb project and their testing in Algeria, Israeli scientists were there in the labs. They were there in the test centers, monitoring, not just monitoring, but actually actively helping to carry out the French tests. So we should see the early French atomic tests in Algeria as being both French tests and de facto Israeli tests
And this is why, of course, there's nothing on record actually confirming Israel's possession of nuclear weapons, because they themselves have covertly engaged in testing their own weaponry via France and, as I understand it, also South Africa. Am I right, John?
Yes, that's true. In my opinion, and certainly many scientists believe that in 1973, maybe 76. I don't have my papers right here, but a spy satellite, a U.S. spy Vela spy satellite, detected a nuclear explosion. Seymour Hersh has verified that it actually was the last of three nuclear tests that had been carried out, and that there was a break in the weather for the final test, and that was how it was discovered. But of course, it was actually headline news when it first happened, but it was covered up very, very quickly, and it was buried.
So I guess the thing that bothers me on this whole thing, and let's bring this in a little bit more. We have, obviously, Israel has full nuclear capability, have full delivery capability. They're all ready to launch at any time. I was in the process of plotting all the nuclear strikes myself during Desert Storm that we anticipate Israel to do. So we have the French have full capability, we have the British have full capability, okay? We know that we have Pakistan that has full capability, we know that India has full capability, we know the Soviet Union has full capability.
Korea?
No, pardon? Korea does not have full
Korea
capability.
Doesn't have any capability.
You don't think North Korea
no.
has capability?
No, North Korea has exploded three very, very primitive devices, and I would personally argue that all three of them were failures. None of them, even approached the magnitude of the Hiroshima bomb. Magnitudes of lower. So in terms of having any meaningful nuclear program, it's illusionary. It really doesn't.
So that's more of the same of the saber rattling that's going on with Iran. Because it is politically adroit and astute to select out of this group of powers, these nuclear weapon-powered people, so for instance, go after Iran, go after North Korea, and rattle those sabers for whatever reason it is.
Well, Patricia, we have to remember that that Daniel Ellsberg published a famous paper on the issue of U.S. nuclear threats, and he came up with a total of, I believe, 47. And then Arjun Makajani wrote an even better article. It was not well read, but he came up with an even larger number of nuclear threats that the U.S. directed, and it was almost exclusively against third world nations. I mean, it was the threat was made against Russia, against the Soviet Union, a few times, but generally speaking, it was against third world countries. And both Ellsberg and Arjun put it at 50 or more nuclear threats.
Yeah.
I think when we look at the whole thing, I mean, we have to look at what's happening in the Middle East. We have Egypt that's coming apart at the seams. It's totally unstable. Nobody knows what's going to happen. We've got that whole area there of North Africa, and coming into the Middle East is totally unstable. We have Saudi Arabia, and the Al-Saud family has maintained control of all of that for a long, long time. Obviously, I met them when we were in Desert Storm. We were involved working with the royal family and all that stuff. We've got all the stuff with Syria and Lebanon and everything else. We've got Israel around there. We've got Jordan is unstable. We've got Turkey, who knows which way they're going to go at any given time. Iraq is a basket case. Iran, for whatever reason, again, we're looking at nations that were ancient nations that are totally very well developed, and then were totally destabilized over the last few years. So when we look at the capability, we're sitting there with Israel, a very small nation, somewhere about the size of New Jersey. Again, all the atrocities that happened, again, absolutely horrible, all that in World War II. But then we have to look at all happened. The United Nations, again, you know, after the end of World War II, subdivided all those nations and created those nations where we have now Israel and Jordan and Syria and everything else. But what is the underlying thing? What is the underlying threats? What could we anticipate? If we know that Israel has a nuclear capability, what would lead, or how could we prevent Israel from unleashing their nuclear capability on their surrounding nations? It seems to me what's happening now, I mean, they're using depleted uranium extensively, conventional explosions, explosives, other specialized explosives all over. We know that's confirmed. On-site measurements confirm that for sure. We know Israel used DU all the way back in 1973. On-site confirmation for that's been presented in the National Academy of Sciences. We know they use it in the Gaza Strip in 2009. We know that they use it in Lebanon. What would lead or what would happen to drive Israel to unleash its nuclear weapons? And if they did, what kind of retaliation could we anticipate from the other nations? Would that drive Pakistan into unleashing nuclear weapons? Which side would India join on? Which side would Soviet Union? Which side would Russia join on?
Not to mention the fact, and I know you know this, Doug, that once one nuclear weapon is exploded, we're then going to have a subsequent EMP blast that could serve to ignite the nuclear weapons within vicinity to that EMP blast and accidentally trigger detonations. So one alone could do extraordinary injury and harm to thousands upon thousands of people, far beyond what we know to be so. But John, what you write about is how routinely Israel threatens to use these weapons, how they rely upon their possession of weapons to bludgeon people into submission vis-a-vis any of their diplomatic negotiations, how they essentially blackmail the United States into whatever it is that they want and need by threatening to use nuclear weapons. Tell us about that,
right.
John.
Right. So Francis Perrin, who was the chief French nuclear scientist made a quote to the effect that we, the French, always thought that the reason, the primary reason for the Israeli nuclear arsenal was to threaten the United States. And he meant that in the sense that Israel would hold that over the head of the United States and say, you know, if you don't do what we want, if you don't give us what we want, then we will use the bomb. And in fact, in the 1973 war, things were looking pretty bad, pretty grim for Israel. Things were not going the way that was expected. And in fact, Israel played the card with Nixon and Kissinger, by all accounts. Seymour Hersh's book has a good description of this. Kissinger and Nixon were absolutely furious, but they initiated this enormous arms transfer. So that's one way that Israel uses nuclear weapons. And another way that it uses its nuclear weapons is in a phrase that was uttered by Shimon Peres, who's the father, the political father of the Israeli program. He said that we can use our nuclear arsenal in order to maintain or to freeze the status quo, because generally speaking, Israel is in a position of power, so therefore Israel tends to like the status quo. So they use their nuclear weapons in order to maintain the status quo. Back in 1993, Doug is absolutely correct that the Israeli nuclear strategy doctrine states that if Israel is attacked by ballistic missiles, that it will automatically assume, before they even land, that these are either nuclear tipped or have chemical or biological weapons. And it was and is Israel's policy, if they are attacked by missiles from another sovereign state, that they will respond using nuclear weapons. And behind the scenes, Bush, the first Bush, did some very heavy-duty jawboning and Baker, and sat down and essentially told Israel, you know, you will not retaliate. And Seymour Hersh says that it happened then. He says you cannot count on it ever happening again. So Doug is correct. The Middle East is a tinderbox that's going up in flames, and Israel is the sole owner of a sophisticated nuclear arsenal. So it's a not good situation.
John, where does Egypt fall into this whole situation? Now, the United States has provided Egypt with conventional weapons and tanks and armors, obviously depleted uranium and everything else, for a very long time. We have troops stationed there right now backing them up. Where does Egypt come into play, and what is the stability of Egypt as far as what would they do? Or more important, what do they have access? What type of weapons do they have access to, such that they could retaliate? I guess what was frightening to me is, if Israel had launched a full-scale invasion of the Gaza Strip any time in the last week or two, or in the near future, what is the probability that Lebanon, Egypt, Syria, Saudi Arabia, Iraq would all just automatically come down totally with everything they have, even they only use conventional munitions?
In other words, will we all be blown to hell and back?
The practical answer is that they wouldn't. And the reason that they wouldn't is that Israel's military is just so superior to all of the Arab militaries combined that it's literally a joke. But what very well could have happened, and it still may happen, some version of this, is that Egypt would open its borders to Gaza, and that would precipitate a reoccupation of Gaza by Israel, and that would obliterate whatever fragments are left left of the peace process and the diplomatic fallout with the other Middle Eastern nations. It's hard to tell how significant it would be. I mean, because you have the Gulf states, you have Saudi Arabia, Qatar, United Arab Emirates behind the scenes. They all have a very good relationship with Israel for public consumption. They'll talk about supporting the Palestinians, but they all have their own trade relations with Israel, and they all have their backdoor diplomatic relations with Israel. So, it's an unstable situation, it's just difficult to imagine any of the Arab states being able to mount any kind of a meaningful attack on Israel, unlike in 1973 or even unlike 1976.
Doug, now, if you could, speak about the American first strike policy. You were out there in Desert Storm, and you knew you were targeting this. You were preparing those cruise missiles or planning for those cruise missile attacks. Tell us about that, dear. Tell us about that. What was that like, for God's sakes? Is that unreal?
I'm not even sure because, you know, our capability during Desert Storm, obviously we knew that Iraq had full chemical and biological capability that was provided to them by the U.S. Army, the U.S. military in Germany and England. That's in the Regal Commission report prepared for the U.S. Senate. It was subject of a made-for-TV movie we did called Thanks for Grateful Nation, starring Ted Danson and Mark Helgenberger. The most frightening part about this is when we made the decision in December of 1990 that we were going to destroy Iraq's chemical and biological stockpiles in place and obviously go into any nuclear capability also destroy it, and we made that decision. And that we did at CENTCOM. Individuals can verify that very easily. All you have to do is go to General Schwarzkopf's autobiography. It doesn't take you Hebrew and go to page 390, and you can read all about it. And so we made that decision. Now, the frightening thing about this, because of the nuclear capability, chemical and biological capability, the weapon systems, we had to prepare for everything. So that's what we were teaching. And not only teaching the medical care for it, but the environmental cleanup and everything else, it was a frightening, frightening time. Bowers Raiders, again, you know, too many are dead now, as you know, and everybody is sick from the work that we did. But it was very frightening because when we knew that Iraq had the capability and all anticipation was that they were going to have a chemical strike on Israel.
That's correct.
We absolutely knew, that the first missile Scud that went in with confirmation of chemical or biological on it, and to this day, thank God there were just conventional explosives, but the first confirmation of it, we knew that the nukes were going to fly. In January,
we were preparing to strike.
We
were going to retaliate against their use or known use, acknowledged use of chemical weapons with our own nuclear weapons. That's first strike, and this is consistent with Israel's policy. Please go on, Doug.
Well, I mean, you know, we're sitting there, we're preparing because, you know, England, Great Britain also has first use strike, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they got first use, no one, you know, doesn't need
first
anything.
First strike. Mm-hmm.
That's a given. But one of the things that were frightening to us is because of the lay of the terrain and the small areas and everything, we have to understand the nuclear weapons we have capability of it. We're not only looking at just conventional damage from high explosives, which is a nuclear weapon ain't nothing but, you know, incredible amounts of high explosives. But then we have all of the downwind hazards and everything else. And because of the primary winds in all that area, everything was going to hit right into the populated areas. Now, the other thing we had to worry about, as you mentioned, we've got the whole thing of EMP, electronic magnetic pulses, and all the other stuff. There's a whole host of byproducts. And today, the U.S. military and most militaries and most nations are basically on solid-state electronics. And that means 5 and 12 volts.
Mm-hmm.
Very low current devices, and everything else is solid-state devices. Well, anytime you have a nuclear weapon or anything like this, obviously it's going to destroy all these things. And again, this is where hardening comes into place. So we were looking at losing all communications, all control of everything, if anything was popped immediately or whatsoever, and it's still a main problem. So we're looking at all of this stuff, and we had to plan for it. And again, the same thing, once we start popping those things, we're going to have all the other releases. And so we just have an environmental catastrophe beyond comprehension.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there was no doubt in our mind at all that Israel would have a full nuclear strike if Iraq did pop any scuds with Chem or Bio-on Israel, and they didn't do it during Desert Storm. No.
Now, they've got a tactical, John, you know they have tactical nuclear weapons, and they have nukes that are as small as hand grenades. So they would conceivably launch a tactical weapon. But what about, as Doug points out, what about what would happen afterwards, thereafter? I mean, I realize this is all hypothetical, but...
I don't think that hypothetical. I mean, you know, it was because the Iraq essentially acted as the adult in the room and did not use chemical and biological weapons.
Let me correct one thing on behalf of those veterans who are suffering from what is called Persian Gulf War illness, very briefly, if I might. And, Doug, you know this to be true. The Iraqis did not use outright full-fledged, full-strength sarin, mustard, phosgene, or whatever brand of chemical weapons. But what they did do, and what we know to be true, is that their methodology was to mix these weapons together, these chemicals together, and deploy weapons in such a way, so in low intensity, so that, in fact, there could be no firm confirmation of a chemical weapon. Fox signals were out there all along, constantly going off. There was all kinds of alarms going off.
We had total confirmation. I mean, we had confirmation of scuds with chemicals down in Escan Village.
Well, yeah.
So, I mean, it was all there. But, again, we're looking at when we're looking at things, we can have an acute dose, and we never hit the acute dose. We had low-level doses all
over.
We
had low-level doses, but they were sufficient to sicken people, and that's what I want to get on the record. If in fact anyone is listening to this, any veteran listening to this who was gassed over there because they were not adequately protected in any way, shape, or form, it is important to state, for the benefit of those who are struggling still to get service-connected disability, to state for the record that, in fact, our soldiers were, and everyone in that environment, were indeed exposed to chemical warfare agents as a consequence of, as once was said to me, that chemical weapons were used on all sides, I might add, and or as a consequence of the destruction of Iraqi chemical weapons and or the accidental release of Iraqi CW as we went through destroying their chemical arsenals. And John, you mentioned, by the way, Israel's chemical weapons arsenal. What about that?
Mainly I was quoting the Sunday London Times, and they were interviewing Israeli scientists and former Israeli scientists who were described Israel as possessing the full gamut of chemical weapons and biological weapons. I would assume that if you would confront Israel on this, their response, and if they acknowledged it, which they won't, their response would be very similar to the U.S. response about what they do at Fort Detrick, which is that everything we do is experiments, it's totally defensive, and the only reason why we're doing this is so that we can defend ourselves against somebody else doing it.
But what's interesting about this vis-a-vis chemical and biological warfare and Israel is that Israel has never signed on to a treaty that any of the treaties that would forbid the use of chemical or biological warfare agents.
No, they signed the biological treaty. They didn't sign
the
chemical weapons treaty. But
I understand
The point is that governments sign treaties, but it doesn't necessarily mean they're bound by them.
Yes.
And in a sense, Patricia and Doug, it's kind of irrelevant because Israel, let's be explicit, let's be crystal clear about this. We know that Israel has a very sophisticated, advanced nuclear weapons arsenal. They have the most advanced non-nuclear submarines in the world to launch these missiles. They have a very sophisticated intermediate-range ballistic missile program that can reach the entire Middle East, most of Africa, virtually all of Europe, and up to and including Moscow. They have a nuclear doctrine which calls for using these weapons in war fighting, very similar to the U.S. policy, which, by the way, continues under Obama. We need to be really clear about this because Obama in 2010 issued the Nuclear Posture Review, and so a great deal of attention was paid to the fact that Obama was backing off some of the more extreme positions that the Bush administration held, and particularly this idea that the U.S. would have carte blanche to go after pretty much any nation in the world under any circumstances. But if you actually look at the fine print, the only real change was that we would not attack a signatory of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, attack them with nuclear weapons, unless they were essential. They were called outlier states. The Obama administration called them outlier, and when they were saying that, they weren't talking about Israel, India, and Pakistan.
They're talking about Iran.
But they were talking about Iran, Syria,
exactly.
North Korea, so that exception was carved out, and you can assume that exception could include essentially any nation that the United States wants to make an exception. So it's kind of the exception that's the rule. And if you look at all of the other aspects of Bush's nuclear posture review, they're all still there.
And let's make it clear that Mr. Obama is prepared to spend $352 billion at a time when we are providing and cutting back on all of our welfare programs, our schools, at a time when our discretionary funding, those programs which are deemed discretionary, such as care for the elderly, the handicapped, so forth and so on, at a time when we are spending as little as we spent in 1976, we are now preparing to spend $352 billion over the next decade to upgrade and modernize our nuclear arsenal. So you tell me how Mr. Obama ever won a Nobel Peace Prize. That is the most ludicrous thing I have ever heard of in my life.
Well, there is a silver lining here, Patricia.
Oh,
you're absolutely right. We're talking about unprecedented levels of spending to completely rebuild the nuclear weapons complex. This is to guarantee the nuclear weapons capability up to and past 2050. But the silver lining is that, as you said, it's really, really expensive. And so now some of the conservative Republicans are starting to make noises that it's too expensive. So it may turn out to be that we beat it back the way we used to beat it back in the old days by arguing dollars and cents. So,
well, scream out to God's ears, but I swear to you, and Doug, I know you'll agree with me on this, as we now have, as you know, we've got 5,113 warheads that we know of. And you know, Doug, you are certainly familiar with the sophisticated technology underway. We're developing things like dial-a-yield warheads, and let's not forget neutron bombs, and you know Israel's got neutron bombs as well. Talk about that for a little bit, John.
Well, we've had dial a megatonnage bombs for a long time,
yes.
for 20 or 30 years, but you're right. The technology is tremendously advanced now, especially in certain areas. For example, the advent of the global positioning system
GPS.
Satellites
mm-hmm.
Mean that when we launch, say, a Trident submarine or an MX, that we can put a warhead down to within a, let's say, a 300-yard radius, a half a world away. And that's enough to target individual Russian launch sites. So that's one area. Another area is anti-submarine warfare. And one of the legacies of the Cold War is that the United States came out with a tremendous, tremendous technological advantage over Russia. So Russia ended up with no money, with a ballistic submarine fleet, where they could only put out one or two submarines at a time. That their ballistic missiles were relatively archaic compared to ours. They just did not and do not have the technological capability that we have. And the problem, there's a couple problems here. One is that the good news is that we are decreasing our arsenals with the START and the START II treaty. The number of deployed warheads is down to, you know, a pretty low number. I think about 2,500, 2,600
on each
side. In terms of strategic weapons.
John, but may I interject that you know full well that this decrease is only a decrease of those weapons that are considered outmoded.
That's the point I'm trying
right.
to make, is that these are obsolete weapons, and that Russia's weapons are nowhere near as capable as our weapons, as the United States weapons, but at the same time, both the United States and Russia are on launch on warning. That means that everything is controlled by computers. And so literally within a 15-minute time frame, if a computer makes a decision and it's not overridden by a human being, then the missiles could be launched. And one of the problems with the fact that the Russian system is so obsolete is in that the U.S. system is so technologically advanced, is that when you look at that in conjunction with the anti-ballistic missiles that we are deploying in Poland and Kazakhstan in surrounding the Soviet Union in order and saying, well, these are targeted against Iran, we're trying to protect you. Well, nobody in Russia believes that. What the generals in Russia believe is that the U.S. is gearing up so that if the bombs fly, that they will use the ABM to mop up. So, and that's the whole idea of first strike, is you have to fire first and then use the ABM to wipe out whatever retaliation
incoming.
There is.
Yes,
well,
right.
Russia doesn't have an ABM system. We do. So
well, that's assuming that ABM system works, because this is, as you know, my area of study is to examine how well a weapon system operates within that portion of the electromagnetic spectrum it is intended to operate within. The whole notion of ABM, of course, is to dud incoming missiles, and the bloody truth of it is, and or to knock them out of the air as they're incoming, vis-a-vis Patriot missiles. The bottom line is that our ABM system does not work. That has not been proven. This is a bloody weaponeer's wet dream. And that's all there is to it.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more, Patricia, but the problem isn't whether or not it's going to work. The problem is perceptions
exactly.
that it might work, and not just perceptions on the part
exactly.
of the Soviet Union, or Russia, but perceptions on the part of the insane war planners who actually believe their own propaganda.
Exactly.
So the go back to 1973. Nixon and Kissinger were the ones that pushed and signed the ABM treaty because they understood how destabilizing it was. And then in 2002, Bush pulled us out of it. And you'll notice, by the way, that President Obama has not rescinded that order and has not reinstituted, you know, the ban on anti-ballistic missiles. He's pushed forward, in fact, and Reagan's Star Wars.
And let me add something that ought to chill everybody's bones, and I'm sure we're aware of it, and our listeners might be aware of it. Now Obama is deploying troops in Australia and Singapore with the idea in mind of challenging China and China's perceptions of nationhood. China, with one-sixth of the people of the world in China, this man is now deploying forces with an idea in mind of taking on China. We are engaged in absolutely mad empire building. We got to stop this nonsense.
Well, in fact, Doug, you're getting cut out here, but let me just make this point here, is that what you're talking about is something called the Rumsfeld Doctrine. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but this was articulated by Donald Rumsfeld. It was a fairly complicated doctrine, but it had to do with the fact that we have to be able to fight total war. We have to be able to fight three different wars at the same time.
It had to do with
building coalitions that would be temporary coalitions, and essentially, when you look at what Obama is doing in terms of confronting China right now, and what he's doing in Africa with AFRICOM, and what he's trying to do in the Middle East, but failing, is carrying out the Rumsfeld Doctrine. I was looking at Obama's position today, and then reading the Rumsfeld Doctrine, and it's amazing how point for point. Essentially, Rumsfeld won.
The frightening thing about this thing is, you know, we've got all the nuclear weapons capability, and for me, they're horrific, and I've been so close. I mean, I controlled the systems at one point, maintained, and, you know, had the opportunity to operate them, but everything was totally locked down and tight. We had everything very carefully controlled. Conventional explosives, conventional systems and everything else, I mean, we're sitting there going along and talking about nuclears, but again, we come on bound to it. I can guarantee you, when I flew 38 missions of B-52s and, you know, 70,000 pounds bombs, it obliterates everything. And then during Desert Storm, I had the capability and, again, the assigned duty to assess the weapon systems and what happened. And what we saw just with conventional weapons was horrific. And when we looked at depleted uranium weapon systems of all the different types, and they're not just against armor but against everything else, it was horrific. Mm-hmm. What would it take, or how can we go about this, John, to get in some stability where we're not going at each other, or the possibility of threatening just conventional, or if we lead from conventional in the chemical bile, which will lead immediately in the nuclear strike? What is the probability of getting some stability? Because we're looking at these nations here throughout the Middle East as incredibly unstable. I don't see the United States government or anybody in our nation have any capability of really holding it all together, because why do those nations have to pay any attention to us? And where are we at, and how can we do to gain some stability so we don't have the probability of nuclear or all-out conventional weapons warfare?
Well, Chairman Mao called nuclear weapons a paper tiger because he thought that it would be politically impossible for them to be used. And I think that he had a point, but I think that the problem is that we're facing a brave new world of depleting resources. I mean, there's a lot of propaganda now about fracking and, you know, natural gas, and the U.S. is going to be an energy exporter and bigger than Saudi Arabia and so on. But the reality is that resources are getting more and more and more hard to find. They're getting more and more expensive in terms of money and in terms of energy to produce. And Bill Arkin has been writing a series of books that he calls Energy Wars, and he's been predicting that we're going to see more and more and more regional conflicts that are ensuing over energy resources and over other non-renewable resources.
Including water, I might add.
You look at most of the population of the world right now, and again, incredible numbers of population where they have virtually very low societal and everything else is India and China. What happens when those nations start developing or require the residents of those nations desire the same living standard that here in the United States or Europe, Western Europe we have, or England or Australia? What happens then? What is the instability? I mean, throughout the Middle East, I mean, most of those nations are still in a Stone Age.
That's essentially what's happening right now. So the price of oil is still roughly $100 a barrel, and it doesn't appear that it's going to go down. And a big part of that is that China and India are wanting and purchasing more and more and more oil, and they're willing to pay a higher and higher price. And then, so the question is, and this is having an impact on the European economy, Japanese economy, and I think especially the U.S. economy. So I wish that I had a good answer. I think that, you know, what we need to do is to recognize that, it's a change.
John, please, quickly, give your name and number, how people can contact you. We're coming up to the end of this program, and we know you're not God, but you can't really tell us the answers to these questions.
What you can
give us is your phone number and contact information so that
Let me give you my email. It's my name, JohnStein. EACH number 1 at Verizon.net.
Please repeat that and do it slowly, John.
JohnStein, the number 1, that's all one word, lowercase, at Verizon.net. And people can get in touch with me. You can go on the internet and look at Washington Report on Middle East Affairs for my paper on Israel and Iran. Or you can go to the Nuclear Files and look at my long paper on the Israeli program.
Let me leave you with this thought, too, if I could. We've been on air for 1 hour, and in 1 hour, this country has spent $60 million. That's more than $1 million a minute on warfare. And conceivably, at least one veteran has killed him or herself in this 1 hour.
Ladies and gentlemen, a lot to think about. Again, the Progressive Radio Network providing information, things to consider. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Have a good evening.